Hello, good evening. Welcome to the NEA BPD Sunday evening call-in series. This is Jim Breeling. We have some announcements and developments before we get to our very impressive and exciting presentation here this evening. And want to note, if you have looked at the NEA BPD website in the top center, we have lost a wonderful person and a fantastic family connections leader, Debbie Davidson. And there's a link there to her presentation at a conference in Atlanta last year. Very dynamic. I just finished moving it, and it's after hearing and seeing her dynamic energy, and it's so sad to think of her no longer being here. But there's a 19-minute videotape that you can see through YouTube or through the NEA BBT website. And Perry Hoffman knew Debbie Davidson well and asked her to talk a little bit about Debbie and our loss.
I just wanted to let people know and echo Jim's words that this is a terrible loss for so many people. She was an incredible mother, wife, lawyer, had done a lot of things in her life, and probably for the last 4 years was very involved with NEABPD. She was running family connections, courses, teleconnections. I think every week she was running something for families. In fact, she did one of the groups at her hospital bed while she was having chemotherapy. And this past June, she came up to McLean Hospital where she gave a two-day presentation along with her sister, Susan Davidson, and Marie-Paul DiValdivia, where they taught family members the skills from family connections. So it's a terrible loss for all of us, and I do encourage you to go on our website and listen to her speech, which was made exactly a year ago today. So we hope to do some sort of award in her name so that her name will live on for all the work that she did for Family Connections and families. So thank you, Jim, for giving me the opportunity to say something.
You know, when you see the videotape, she's so young and energetic and so articulate that it's really sad. On the website, though, the world does go on, and I think Debbie would want us to continue on with more rather than less energy. The Dialectics of Validation Conference that the Frankenstorm Sandra forced cancellation of last Friday has been rescheduled for December 7th. And next Saturday, November 10th, there's a Healing Hearts of Family and Living with Borderline Personality Disorder in Texas. Last week, we heard from Mary Zanarini, wanted to mention about her follow-up of people who initially were inpatients at McLean. And in the course of questions and answers, Dr. Zanarini mentioned her work with adolescents and assessing them for borderline personality disorder, and that they were looking exactly the same as adults. And this is another challenge to our DSM criteria for diagnosing the disorder, which has presumed that personality does not crystallize until late adolescence, early adulthood. And I just wanted to alert you because there's an array of studies that are early clinical notions about what comprises a personality disorder, and the criteria are probably, undoubtedly, will change significantly. And Dr. Zanarini's data will be an important one to question the role of personality in this. There's also, talking about adolescents, videos from a March 9th conference of this year, NEA BPD, and you can access that through the website on diagnosing and treating adolescents with borderline. So, very timely. Now, we don't have a lot of research about borderline personality disorder, but there's a higher rate than you would expect that gets top billing in the very, very best and most demanding journals, and I want to mention one of them. The Archives of General Psychiatry is one of the two top-rated scientific journals in psychiatry. In the October 2012 issue, had the lead paper, the very first research report, which is a prime position for recognition, concerned research from Germany on the disorder from a very productive group there, on alterations in the default mode network connectivity during pain processing and borderline personality disorder. Mouthful title. If you go to the Archives of General Psychiatry on the web, you can access and read the whole article. The big thing here out of this is that this is more biology in terms of our understanding of disorder, and that people with borderline in general are less sensitive to pain and its adversity, and also in switching from one focus to another. And the view of the authors, this supports a mindfulness approach, pointing to it. But I think it's another indication of our advances in biology of the underlying characteristics and dynamics of the disorder that will point to new approaches. The other thing I want to notice, there's something in England called the Cochrane Reviews. And these are reviews using meta-analysis. This is a statistical procedure that allows the combining of data across studies. And it looks at different questions in the health area. And they publish reviews then for people outside the particular field to research and how it looks. And it's really what I look to for how the standing in the area. We get a little bit over-enthused in our own areas about what we know and the confidence that we can have in it, have in the findings as we see them. So it's good to get an independent, empirical perspective from outside the field. One nice thing is there are now 5 Cochrane reviews of borderline personality disorder, 2 concerning the use of medications, 1 concerning a crisis intervention, and 2 concerning psychotherapy. The most recent one is in August of this year. And the thing I wanted to point out here, it finds it no surprise that the most support for any of the therapy models is for dialectic behavior therapy. But it is not conclusive. And the other therapies all somewhat lag behind DBT. None of them to the status that one would say that they are really strongly supported, encouraging, but the data is not yet there to be strongly supported. There is also totally inadequate data to say whether one is better than another or that they're all equally effective. We really don't know. So I just wanted to, good news here in terms of progress, but also a real challenge and what we need to know yet. With that, I want to, oh, by the way, on this article in the journal Psychiatry, forgot to mention, the second author of the pain sensitivity, if you will, article, Christian Smolt, is a young German psychiatrist, and he was the first NEA BBT Junior Research Award recipient, given in Los Angeles about 9 years ago. And he's gone on to be very productive. The award really recognized a major future productive person. And we hope we can involve them in some way in these call-in sessions because they're doing a lot of work that is very interesting. Our speaker tonight, Ed Selby, is going to be in that group too. He's a new PhD, already more than 30 research papers, and not just papers, but some very innovative work, such as going to present tonight. He also is starting out at Rutgers as a new faculty position, post-PhD, and he is one of 2 recipients of NARSED Junior Research Awards that were funded, the money raised by Families for Borderline Personality Disorder Research. And I think when you hear his presentation tonight, you're going to see that the selection of the Scientific Council of his high merit and potential promises is very well validated. So with that, let me stop and let Dr. Selby begin his presentation. Hello?
Jim, hold on. Let's see what happened. Don't hang up. You're there, Jim, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, somehow he must have gone on mute, so let's let me just see what happened and see if I can get him back. Ed, are you back with us?
I'm unmuted now. It said somewhere in there that I was muted, and now I'm here.
Wonderful.
You're on.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks, Jim, for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here speaking to everyone tonight. So just to kind of get started here, I hope everyone has the slides that I sent out. And just to notice, when I present this in person, I'm able to sort of control the rate of going through the slides. And it doesn't really work as well for handouts. So hopefully I'll be able to keep you on the same slides that I'm talking about.
But Jim, Ed, can I just interrupt? If people do have questions during their presentation, they should email neabpd@aol.com, and we'll get them to you. Is that okay?
Yep, that
Good.
Sounds
Thank
great.
Thank you.
Great. So today I'm going to be talking about emotional cascades and sort of a new paradigm for trying to understand a major aspect of problems in BPD. But to start with that, I want you to go to the next slide where it says dysregulated behaviors. And getting started in this area, really I start by focusing on dysregulated behaviors. But I have a question mark on this slide because it kind of makes you, there's no real clear definition at the moment as to what a dysregulated behavior is. And generally in my work, I've defined it as any behavior that a person does that ends up having harmful consequences to themselves as a result. But let me give you some common examples. So in the subsequent slide, you can see a number of different pictures of things going on. In one of the upper pictures, you see a woman binging on food. Beneath that, you see some self-injury marks. Next to that, you see a couple of people fighting, arguing, yelling with each other. Still at the top, you see a woman who is purging. Beneath her, you see someone throwing money in there. That's supposed to represent sort of like impulsive shopping or problematic spending. Below that, you see alcohol. So problems like alcohol and drug use. And then next to that, you see people fighting. So these are a wide variety of different behaviors that are not exclusive to borderline personality disorder. Some people can have one or two of these behaviors. Some people can have many of these behaviors. And the next one I want to point out that often sort of comes to mind with these is also suicide attempts is often sort of grouped into this dysregulated behavior category. But what, if anything, do all these wide variety of behaviors have in common? And if you look across the literature, what you see comes up time and time again in each of these behaviors is negative emotion. People are usually experiencing increases in negative emotion that are somehow motivating or driving these behaviors. Now, moving away from this a little bit to the next slide, I want to point out that borderline personality disorder is a disorder where you can find all of these behaviors. As opposed to something like binging and purging, which you just might find in a eating disorder, you can find many of these behaviors in borderline personality disorder. Now, since this is a BPD specialty group, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about what borderline personality disorder is, but I just want to point out that some of the major criteria involve both emotional and behavioral problems. So you see things like the turbulent emotions, suicidal and self-injurious behavior, the dysregulated behaviors that I just talked about. All these are major facets of BPD symptoms. Just to kind of further drive home the point of why it's important to understand sort of these behaviors and emotional experiences in BPD is that BPD has a major health impact on society. On an individual level, many of them, in addition to suffering and having many problems throughout their life, they also have problems with suicidal behavior, and many end up dying as a result of their disorder. And that itself is a major reason to continue trying to understand this disorder and help people that are suffering from it. But in addition to that, there's also society costs that, you know, could be improved if we can help people with this disorder. For example, people with BPD are frequent users of ERs due to self-injury, drug problems, nutritional issues, binging and purging. And then another major issue with BPD is that current treatments are long-term and intensive. As Jim mentioned, dialectical behavior therapy is proving to be a very helpful therapy, although there's some other potential candidates. But one of the major issues with it is it's still about a two-year program. So, you know, that's a long time of treatment compared to other disorders. So if we can find ways to increase the efficiency of these treatments, that would be very helpful. And that's what drives a lot of this work that I work on. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see the picture with a girl looking very upset, and it says emotion dysregulation. And this sort of connects, is where I start to try and connect emotional issues in BPD with behavioral issues. And part of this work builds off of Marsha Linehan's theory in 1993, where she postulated that people with BPD experience emotion dysregulation in sort of three ways. They have elevated emotional intensity. When they get upset, they get really upset, much more than would be justified by the situation or that most people would respond to. They're emotionally sensitive. When they get when something upsets them, or you or me, we might brush it off and say, "Oh, you know, that's not great, but oh well." Whereas somebody with BPD tends to become much more sensitive to that and go into an emotionally intense response. And then finally, Linehan stated that they have long-lasting emotions. When they get upset, they tend to stay upset for quite a while, much longer than people without BPD would, unless potentially they might do a behavior as a way of sort of bringing back emotional baseline. So these three facets of emotional intensity, emotional sensitivity, and long-lasting emotions are meant to explain sort of what's the emotion dysregulation that's going on in this disorder. If you advance to the next slide that says theories of dysfunction, this is sort of where my work has come in. Linehan has done great work for the field with designing and testing DBT and coming up with this theory. But when I first read it, I was wondering how is this emotion dysregulation specifically connecting to the dysregulated behaviors? You often see these two parts of BPD, but yet there's no real research trying to link them as to why they would be connected. And that's where my research has really come in, is trying to understand, as Kasdan calls it, theories of dysfunction. And what Kasdan says is if we want to understand, or if we want to make our treatments better, we need to understand the mechanisms of psychopathology involved better. So rather than just tweaking the treatments and seeing if they work better, we can do better if we can find out what is exactly going on, or at least as best as we can, and try and build our treatments to, based on that information. So this is where my work on emotional cascades comes in, if you go to the next slide with the picture of the waterfall. In this model, the goal was to try and, you know, bridge the experience of emotion dysregulation with the experience of behavioral dysregulation. Because the common thing that comes up is, well, if they're so upset, why don't they just do something like go talk to a friend or go just take a stroll and calm down? Why do they do these behaviors that are so harmful to themselves? And my work has suggested that they might be experiencing emotional cascades that sort of make it those other options not very good options. So in this model, if you advance to the next slide, and it's a little bit complicated, but I'm going to walk through each of the parts step by step, so don't get too lost in it. This model suggests that people with BPD experience emotional cascades. And in an emotional cascade, it starts with the experience of an emotion, usually a negative emotion. And then what happens from there is my thinking, as well as the thinking of my colleagues, is that people with BPD begin to experience rumination in response to a negative emotion. Now, rumination refers to thinking repetitively about an upsetting problem over and over in a way that's very repetitive. And the thinking is that other research has shown that when people ruminate, it tends to actually make them more upset. So the more you're thinking about it and mulling about it and being upset about the problem, the more it makes you upset. But what other research has also found is that when you have increased rumination and increased emotional intensity, the more upset you get, the more you tend to start to ruminate, the more you start to focus on the upsetting problems in the first place. So you get this sort of feedback loop where you have the rumination making you more and more upset, and then the progressively increasing negative emotion making you more ruminative and more intensely focused on the upsetting problem. And this is where we think results in the experience of an emotional cascade, where it's this building cycle of ruminating and getting more upset and ruminating. And then this is where we think behavioral dysregulation comes in, where these different behaviors come in, is these different dysregulated behaviors are used to sort of stop the emotional cascade, because each of these behaviors, if you look at them, has potent physical sensations. So, for example, potential feelings of pain or the sight of blood and self-injury, the psychoactive effects of a drug, or the taste or fullness in binge eating, all of those sensations might allow the person to stop ruminating and focus on the sensations. So instead of thinking about the problem, they're thinking about the food they're eating and the taste of it. And that, as a result, it short-circuits the emotional cascade by decreasing the rumination. And as a result, negative emotion is decreased and feelings of relief are felt. And essentially that is why these behaviors might be used an exception to other behaviors like taking a stroll. If you're going for a walk when you're upset, you're still thinking about it. Or if you go talk to a friend, you're often talking to your friend in a ruminative, upset way. So these behaviors might have really potent sensations that are distracting and helpful at the time, but hurtful in the long run. So advancing to the next slide, just sort of have a couple orange shapes on there. Much of this work has been theoretical, but it's also been empirical, trying to link the connection between emotion dysregulation and behavioral dysregulation in BPD. And I'm going to walk you through a couple studies where we've found this connection and found emotional cascades as a potential link between these two experiences. So if you advance the next slide, where it's got sort of a supernova-looking thing, we get the difficulty of how do we see emotional cascades? And this has been an ongoing difficulty for this kind of research, because when we're talking about emotional cascade, we're talking about a very abstract, sort of fast-happening, out-in-the-real-world process that it can be hard to sort of manipulate or observe in a lab. But yet, there are ways that we can do this, and they sort of have shown evidence that emotional cascades may be at play in borderline personality disorder. So moving to the next slide, where it says cascades is a mechanism, and I think maybe the next slide there has the intro to the study. So this is a study that was published in the Journal of Abnormal Psychology by my colleagues and myself in 2009. And in this study, where it says cascades equals mechanism, over 2 years we screened 5,000 undergraduate students and screen them for symptoms of borderline personality disorder. And those who reported five or more symptoms of BPD were invited to come and participate in this lab procedure. And in addition to that, we also allowed for controlled subjects to come in at different times. So as a result from this study, we ended up with about 138 undergraduate students. And of those, 38 had a BPD diagnosis, as defined by the SCID-2, so that's a pretty good clinical measure showing that a good number of them had BPD and strong BPD symptoms. And all participants completed a series of questionnaires, and then they also completed an experimental rumination induction, which I'm going to walk you through. Now, advancing to the next model, which has a bunch of arrows, This is a structural equation model, which is sort of a complicated correlational method for trying to build a model from the data that you've got present. And this data came from the questionnaires that the participants answered. But to try and keep it simple for people, since it can be kind of complicated, I've got pictures on there that I think help sort of show you what each of these parts of the model is measuring. So in the right, you've got BPD is signified by the picture of the woman. In the middle of the model, you've got the waterfall, which is a way of signifying this is the emotional cascades. And then on the bottom side, you've got the behaviors. And what each of these are is different questionnaires or interviews that people completed, and you can put these into this model and have them form a latent variable, which is what these circles are. So that's a way of measuring. From all these different measures, you can get one nice measure of the issue you're trying to get at. So that's what these pictures represent. Now, when you do this kind of structural equation model, we found these yellow paths, if you see those, were significant. And what this means was that if you look at the two yellow paths, the first one goes from BPD to emotional cascades. That shows that there is this significant relation between those with BPD symptoms to experience emotional cascades. Now, on the other side, from going from emotional cascades to dysregulated behaviors, we also found that there was a strong association between the experience of emotional cascades and the experience of dysregulated behaviors. Now, if you look in the middle section there where it says 36 and the little arrow that says 19, what that shows is that when you put, if you don't bring in emotional cascades into this, you have a strong relationship between BPD and dysregulated behaviors, as you would expect given it's a diagnostic symptom. But when you put emotional cascades into this measure, into this kind of model, the direct relationship disappears. So what this is suggesting is that the effects of BPD on dysregulated behaviors may be flowing through the experience of emotional cascades. So that's some evidence that maybe this is one way of connecting these experiences in BPD. Now, if you go to the next slide, you'll see depression is highlighted in this model. And the reason this is highlighted is because rumination has traditionally been studied in the context of depression in most research. So an important part of this model is showing is that rumination is not just part of depression in borderline personality disorder, as many people with BPD are also simultaneously depressed. And what this shows is that although there was this significant relationship between depression and emotional cascades, there was still this unique aspect of BPD connection to rumination. So what that's saying is that people with BPD ruminate in a way that's unique, that's not accounted for by depression, further supporting that there might be this experience of emotional cascades. Now, if you advance the next slide where it says rumination induction, this is the second part of this study with these undergraduate students. Now, what this induction involved was first we had all participants rate their baseline emotions using the PANAS, which is a very standardized measure. So they rated both their positive and their negative emotions at the start of the study. And at this, at the time of this induction, we had them engage in a ruminative thought for 5 minutes. So we told them to think about something that was really upsetting to them and that was currently problematic for them. And all participants did this for 5 minutes. And then after this induction, we gave them again the PANAS to see how their emotions had changed after 5 minutes of thinking in this manner. And if you advance to the next slide, which shows a couple bar graphs, this is the emotions before and after. If you look at the first two columns, that's the BPD group. And if you look at the second two columns, that's the control group. The yellow columns are at baseline, and the red columns are after the rumination induction. So you can see in this model right here that at baseline, the BPD group was already more upset. So even without having done anything, they were already experiencing more negative emotion. And then you can see after the induction, the BPD group was even more upset, as you might expect. But what's really important in this kind of experiment is to not look at the sort of basic levels, rather to look at the change in levels, because what the change is signified by these blue arrows represents is reactivity to this task. And what we wanted to see is, did the BPD group experience a more reactive negative emotional increase as a result of this experiment than the control group? And if you go to the slide with the two arrows next to each other, you see that was indeed a significant finding. The BPD group really did experience significantly more reactivity just to this little thing, thinking about a problem task, than the control group. So that's particularly interesting, that even just asking them to think about something upsetting essentially activated this emotion dysregulation, as would be expected by an emotional cascade. So if you go to the next slide, from this study, we got a first sort of glimpse of emotional cascades, and we found evidence that emotional cascades might be involved in dysregulated behaviors. But there were a few limitations that are important to note with this study. First, it was cross-sectional. And what that means is, you know, we don't really have evidence to connect outright that the emotional cascades are causing the behaviors. It could be that the behaviors are leading to more emotion dysregulation, possibly. And then, additionally, it was a student sample, which is, you know, just makes you wonder how much does this apply to people being treated in clinics or having difficulty out in the real world outside the college setting. So to build on this research, in the last few years, I've been working on experience sampling methodology. So with experience sampling methodology, you have participants carry Palm Pilots, which are now sort of becoming a defunct technology with smartphones replacing them. But this is you know, sort of a pre-smartphone, and you would carry this, and it would, throughout the day, alert you multiple times. It would beep. And each time it would beep, the participants would answer a series of questions to try and understand their emotions, thoughts, and recent behaviors. So using experience sampling research, if you advance to the next slide, this is methods, I aim to get a sample of people with BPD, both from the community as well as students, because I didn't have enough resources to get them all from the community. But as a result, we ended up getting 47 dysregulated participants, and I'll explain what dysregulated means in a second. And we got about 60% of the people were from the community, and about 42% were from the student body. Now, 16 had a diagnosis of BPD, but all of them exhibited enough dysregulated behaviors to meet entry into the study. And for this, we said, to be in this study, you have to have at least 4 dysregulated behaviors in the last 2 weeks, self-reported. So this included things like self-injury, binge eating, substance use, impulsive shopping, yelling at someone, throwing something, or physical fights. And if you rated any combined four of those behaviors, then you were allowed to participate in the study, and you then engaged in the experience sampling. So if you advance to the next slide, all people were given the mini diagnostic interview, which is for things like depression and anxiety, and then as well the SCID BPD module, which is how we confirmed if they had a BPD diagnosis. At the time of this baseline assessment, all participants who were in the study then were trained on how to use the Palm Pilots. They were trained on how to answer the signals when they came up and how to store it and how to take care of it and make sure that they were helping us collect the best data that we could. And then after this, they carried the Palm Pilot for 16 days. They did 2 practice days where they were supposed to respond to it as best they could, but it was practice in case they had questions. They could call and we would help them figure it out. Then after that, they had 14 days of subsequent data collection where they were beeped randomly 5 times throughout the day, and it was structured to beep randomly so they could never predict when it was going to happen, you know, in the morning, noon, afternoon, early evening, and later evening. So that way we could get a good distribution across the day. Now, because this is sort of a busy experiment, we also gave incentives for compliance, so all participants received either monetary benefits or student research credit benefits. But if they completed at least 80% of the signals, that means basically 4 out of the 5 a day, then they got some additional credit or financial compensation. And that worked out well because we got about 90% compliance rates for both groups. Now, each time they answered the signal, they completed an effective assessment. So if you go to that next slide, with effective assessment on that, you see a checklist of different emotions. And they were asked to say, how do you feel right now? We have happy, angry, excited, worried, proud, bored, ashamed, and numb. And people would rate if they felt five a lot or one, none of these. Following this, they would complete a behavioral assessment. Since the last signal, have you done any of the following behaviors? And there was a list that they could check, and they could check multiple behaviors if they had used any of these kinds. Following this, they also complete a rumination assessment. And this is part of a broader sort of thought assessment as opposed to just a straight-out rumination assessment. But with these items, we were able to construct a rumination scale. So if you see with the yellow items, you see, how much are you thinking about right now? A currently upsetting situation, upsetting memories, how to solve a problem. And people could rate these from 1, not at all, to 10, very much so. And using these items, we made a rumination scale that was highly consistent with other rumination scales and looked to be very useful for what we were aiming to do with it. Finally, they also completed an interpersonal assessment where they rated if people had done things like insulted them or rejected them or criticized them, or if they felt like they had failed at something or disappointed themselves in some way. So moving to the slide with a couple yellow lines on it, following completion of the study, we examined the number of dysregulated behaviors reported, and there was a good sample or good number of behaviors reported, which is you know, not good for the people having problems, but it was good for us in terms of we got a lot of what we were aiming to get a use of. So, for example, we had 50 reports of alcohol use, 25 reports of self-injury, 116 episodes of marijuana use, and 62 binge episodes. So that's pretty good for 2 weeks with 47 participants. So moving to the next slide that says predicting emotional cascades and dysregulated behaviors. So this is a study, so that using these data, we recently published the current study, and this is IMPRESS at Personality Disorders Theory, Research, and Treatment, which is a great new personality disorders journal. So if you go to this next slide that says predictive validity, this is, you know, has some different arrows on it, but I'm going to walk you through as to what this was. The goal with this study was to show that emotional cascades preceded the experience of dysregulated behaviors. So essentially with these data, we were trying to predict if the way you're thinking and feeling right now predicts you engaging in behavior within the next 2 to 3 hours. So what we did was we created lag indices, which are a data analytic way of structuring the data so you can use one signal to predict the next signal. And what we expected to see was if people had high rumination and high negative emotion at one signal, not just one, but both, that they would have an increased probability of a dysregulated behavior. And the reason we want to look for both is because sort of the way we've defined an emotional cascade is this process of increasing negative emotion, increasing rumination that kind of builds on itself. So if someone's ruminating without negative emotion, that wouldn't be our way of defining an emotional cascade. That might be just sort of problem solving. Or if they have a negative emotion but no rumination, that might be different than emotional cascade as well. It might be more of like they're feeling a bit down but not in an emotional cascade. And so what we found, if you look at the two numbers at the bottom that are gammas that look like Ys, these show that negative emotion itself was a predictor of a future dysregulated behavior, and rumination on its own was a predictor of a future dysregulated behavior. So those two alone predicted if someone would engage in one of these behaviors in the next 2 to 3 hours. But what you see up there at the top with the big arrow that says gamma equals 0.18 is that's the interaction term. So this showed that that if you had both of these, you had an even greater chance of having one of these dysregulated behaviors. If you go to the next slide with a graph that says three-way interaction at the top, this one shows that there was actually this three-way interaction. So that if you had high BPD symptoms and you had high negative emotion and you had high rumination, you had a high chance of one of these dysregulated behaviors occurring within the next 2 to 3 hours. So if you went into the if you were scoring really, really high, you looked like you had around a 90% chance of having one of these dysregulated behaviors. So that's pretty much exactly what we were looking to see, whereas if you had no BPD, you still had a high chance of a dysregulated behavior if you're having an emotional cascade, but it was less so than if you had BPD. So this further supports our idea that BPD might be a real, might be an extreme continuum with having more emotional cascades than other people without BPD. Moving to the next slide, I just want to point out a few other findings with these data that are either in press or under review. One paper that's almost in press, it's not quite there, is we found that if you look at fluctuations in rumination versus just sort of average level of rumination, that actually predicts a number of self-injury episodes. So what that's showing is that if you sort of go in these rumination cycles where you ruminate a lot and then you don't ruminate, but you ruminate a lot and then you don't, that predicts self-injury. Another study we're working on has shown that rumination levels experienced during this study predicted number of nightmares, especially for those with BPD. So this is a growing area of research on BPD, that they tend to actually experience increased nightmares even beyond experiences like PTSD or abuse. So one thinking is that maybe these emotional cascades might actually follow them into sleep. So when they've been having a hard day and they've been experiencing emotional cascades throughout the day, they might go to sleep and still sort of be ruminating and to some extent and have sort of an emotional cascade in their sleep that leads to things like nightmares. And then another thing we've been looking at is broadness of rumination. So one of the things we're trying to work on is to define on how emotional cascades are different from just traditional rumination. And one of the things we've been looking at is rumination about a whole variety of things as opposed to just one focus problem. So, you know, if someone, let's say, had a bad day at work, are they just ruminating about that one event, or are they ruminating about that day, previous experiences at work, problems at home? And the more problems reported about ruminating on it, has actually been found to increase more dysregulated behaviors. So if you have sort of this, you ruminate about a lot of stuff on a frequent basis as opposed to just one or two things, that predicts more dysregulated behaviors. If you go to the next slide, which has sort of a man standing in, I'm guessing that's Times Square, I should know since I live pretty close to it. But this is sort of meant to explain, so when you look at emotional cascades, there's sort of a, you know, an emotional cascade here, an emotional cascade there. How do we get from an emotional cascade to borderline personality disorder? I mean, how are those two fundamentally connected? And what you get is sort of the momentary level, and then you get the chronic sort of long-term level. And a lot of my work has been trying to understand how this works out. So if you go to the next slide, you see that it says the word emergence. And this is a concept that kind of might help us understand how, you know, having emotional cascades here and there can lead or could possibly lead to borderline personality disorder. So with emergence, this is a term that comes to us from the complexity literature, which says if you have a number of interacting components within a system that are all simultaneously interacting with each other, you can actually end up with a new sort of result. Something new emerges from the system that's greater than the sum of all the parts that are going on underneath. So let me give you an example. One example is an ecosystem. Within an ecosystem, you have water and plants, and you have sunlight, and you have animals moving around, and you have rain. And each of these things you can look at, you know, how the rain affects the insects, how the water flow affects the plants. All these things are interacting. But when they're all interacting simultaneously, you get what we think of as an ecosystem. This whole ecosystem fits together by having all these interactions build up into this one thing. But yet the very existence of the ecosystem can affect all parts within the model. So one change over here, so one change in the water can affect something like both the animals and the moisture and cloud cover and things like that. As another example is an economy. When you think about the economy, it's made up of people who are buying and selling and trading with each other, within countries buying, selling, and trading with each other. And each of them is acting somewhat independently of each other. But yet, as they're acting independently of each other, they're all fundamentally connected. And while simultaneously interacting, you get what we think of as an economy. Building on this concept, if you go to the next slide, it says the emotional cascade model, is a similar effect, I think, is going on in BPD. So within BPD, I have a model here of a whole bunch of different stuff that's going on, because there's a lot going on in BPD. But in the center box, I have emotional cascades and behavioral dysregulation, because I think this is where the heart of the model lies. So all these things are connected through emotional cascades. So if you look at the bottom of the model, you have a whole bunch of different boxes, but I have a couple highlighted just to bring out focus on them. You have invalidation and criticism from others, and distorted cognitions and views of others. And these are things that have been well established in BPD and would make sense in terms of these things are going to contribute to emotional cascades. If someone invalidates a person with BPD, that would likely contribute to an emotional cascade. Now, all these things are interacting with each other. So you see other things such as suicidal behavior, low distress tolerance, things like biological factors, early childhood abuse factors. All these things are interacting in a connected way for people with BPD. And what the end result is as these things are connected, you get more and more emotional cascades and more dysregulated behaviors. And the end result is essentially what we consider to be borderline personality disorder, that when you're experiencing many of these factors all combined, you have BPD. But what's important in this kind of model and what makes it sort of an innovative way of thinking about it is that when you have an emergent phenomenon, that phenomenon then influences the things that make up it. So if you look at the next slide, it has the two arrows going from borderline personality disorder down into things like invalidation and distorted cognitions. And what you get is someone develops BPD and they're having emotional cascades and behaving in dysregulated ways, people may start to get more upset and frustrated with them. Why are you acting this way? Why do you do these things? And that, as a result, can contribute to more emotional cascades and more dysregulated behaviors. Or on the other side, as someone has trouble with dysregulated behaviors, they might start to believe things like, I can't control myself, I'm not worthwhile, or I don't deserve to live, which could contribute into suicidal behavior. So by having this experience, it makes it even worse. So you can see how it's all feeding back to each other and making it a worse experience for the person. Now, I think that this has important treatment implications, if you go to the next slide, because this sort of model kind of helps us see what we're trying to do with treating BPD when you look at it. So if you go to the slide that says dialectical behavior therapy, one of the ways I think that my work is helpful is, although Linehan has stated her initial theory of BPD, it's never been really clearly addressed as to what is the active ingredient of change in dialectical behavior therapy. A number of researchers have sort of put out some things that it might increase sort of emotional clarity and interpersonal skills, all of which I'm sure are correct. But I want to know, like, if you could boil it down to what is the most active ingredient, what is that? And in my opinion, I think it's finding ways to help people cope with emotional cascades. So if you go to the next slide with all the trees. So one of the major facets of DBT is mindfulness training. Throughout 2 years in DBT, you spend week after week practicing many different mindfulness exercises. And mindfulness, the ultimate goal of it is the ability to control what you're going to pay attention to, where you're going to put your thoughts, where you're going to put your focus. What you're going to be essentially learning how to control your mind as opposed to letting your mind run amok. And so this might be done with things by looking at a picture and just describing it and just focusing on the picture. And if your mind starts to wander and think about upsetting things, you bring it back and you focus on the picture. And I think that this mindfulness, the way it works, is stopping emotional cascades, is by helping people start changing their response to upsetting events and from a ruminative emotional cascade response into a more mindful response. You see a decrease in dysregulated behaviors and likely increase in sort of feelings of competence and ability to handle these problems as they come up. But that's just one aspect of DBT. If you go to the next, you see activities. DBT is very activity-focused. It focuses, it says, rather than being upset about your emotions and just not, you know, just being upset and acting out of control with it, we're going to find other things to do that are hopefully going to be helpful to you, but not in the same way, but not harmful. So they often suggest things like exercise or talking to a friend. And I think that these activities are another major focus of DBT, and what's helpful about it is rather than finding, so the behaviors that are dysregulated have the potent sensations that I think are helpful for stopping an emotional cascade. Now, if we can identify other behaviors that are distracting in a similar way but not harmful, then that could hopefully have the desired effect of stopping an emotional cascade without all the problems that result from dysregulated behaviors. So one of the good potential options that's been shown in research is exercise. Has been shown to be really helpful for coping with things like depression or potentially self-injury. But you can see how that one, you know, when you're really exercising hard, it's hard to focus on being upset because you're focusing on exercising, and that could be one helpful way of stopping a dysregulated behavior. But I think there's also some room for other behaviors that aren't currently used as much in DBT. So if you go to the next slide, you see puzzles in there. And although this is a speculative idea on my part, and I don't have any empirical findings supporting it yet, my thing is that puzzles would be a good thing to include in treatment. And when you think about this from the emotional cascade model perspective, it makes a lot of sense. If you're starting to get upset and you recognize that, it might be helpful to do something like a Sudoku puzzle, which is on the bottom there. And this is where you're trying to solve, put all the numbers in the correct boxes. If you're focused on this puzzle, thinking of what is going to go into which box and doing it, and you're doing it the right way, you shouldn't be thinking about the problem. And as a result, you shouldn't be going into an emotional cascade, and you should calm down. One way I often try to relate this to people I've worked with in clinical settings is if I've been mad at someone at times, but then I've had to go do something. I had to go do some work, or I had an appointment to go to, and I'm so busy at the appointment doing whatever's required for the activity that I forget that I'm even mad about what was happening. It's not until later on that I'm like, oh, yeah, I was mad about that. And I think you would see a similar effect if people were able to carry booklets of these puzzles in their pockets, and if they knew they were starting to get upset and could take a break and work on one of these puzzles, it might be an effective strategy for stopping an emotional cascade before it gets going. But more research is needed to see if that would actually have that effect. Another thing that I want to mention briefly is I think from this research spawns the potential for computer-aided therapy. So there is a lot of great work going on, actually by one of my colleagues. If you go to one of the iPhone apps here at Rutgers, is Shireen Rizvi, who's a former student of Linehan's, has been doing some great work on making a DBT coach for iPhone as an iPhone app. And this iPhone app is really good for helping the patients learn the critical DBT skills. So why would iPhone apps be a really good approach for treating BPD? Well, first, they're practical. One of the things I often confront with patients in therapy is a lot of times people treat therapy like church. Not everybody treats church like this, but some people, the only time they think about church is the one time a week that they're in church. And that kind of therapy is not good therapy. Good therapy is when it's someone's thinking about it all the time and how they can apply the skills that they've been learning to different situations. Well, if they've got an iPhone that's helping them do this throughout the week, or an iPhone app, that's exactly what we're looking for. Phone treatments are also efficient in terms of the emotional cascade model. if you want to help someone understand when they're experiencing an emotional cascade and how it's connected to their event, the rumination and negative emotion, why not have them monitor their emotions and thoughts and behaviors like we had them do in my experience sampling study? That's going to potentially be a really good way to say, hey, when I'm ruminating, I'm getting more upset. And then finally, it's economical. If you could apply some of these treatments simultaneously to other treatments like DBT, you might be able to shorten the length of the treatment or make it even better faster. So that's helpful, and that's also engaging. People like to play with their phones. If you could make this as a way to help encourage them make therapy fun versus the one time a week I have to go to therapy, oh, then that would be really helpful. So looking at building on these, if you advance to the next slide where it says changes in behavior, I actually have a paper under review co-authored with Shireen Rizvi where we looked at my experience sampling data. And we graphed over the 14 days. So if you look at the bottom of the graph, it goes 1 to 14. That's daily number of experiences, or that's the days. And on the other axis, you see average daily behaviors. And then in the blue, you see the sort of average for the whole group. And then the greenish line, you see the average for the BPD group. And what you see for both groups here was a significant trend in decreasing behaviors over the 2-week monitoring period. If you go to the next slide, you see rumination on a daily basis over the 2 weeks. Once again, you see, especially for the BPD group, a trend of decreasing rumination on a daily basis. And then finally, if you go to the rumination, which is the third graph, you see another decreasing trend of negative emotion. Now, all of these were significant in terms of the BPD group experienced greater decreases in these problems than the control group over the 2 weeks. And then actually, there was an interaction so that people who experienced decreases in rumination and negative emotion also experienced greater decreases in dysregulated behaviors. So this is potential evidence that having people do assessment, whether daily assessing their emotions, thoughts, and behaviors might actually, the very act of doing that might actually be therapeutic and helpful to them. Now, I want to note that this didn't have a placebo, essentially. There wasn't some other group doing something else on a phone to compare them to see if they did better over the monitoring period. So I actually have a grant in the works that's under review at the moment to see if I can build this into an iPhone app and then test it to a placebo app where it asks them, you know, where are you standing, what are you wearing, sort of questions to see, hopefully, that over a few weeks we would see a therapeutic effect for this kind of group as opposed to the placebo group. So hopefully at some point that study will be done. If you go to the next slide, it says future directions. I just want to mention a few future directions that are going with this research that I'm currently working on or will be working on very shortly. As was mentioned at the start of the talk, I was recently awarded the NARSAB award by the Families for BPD Research. And it was a great honor to receive that award. And this project is going to look at people with BPD and other disorders of emotion dysregulation, for example, bulimia and depression. And we're going to have them do a longer emotion rumination induction, and then we're going to have them hooked up to psychophysiology measures to see if we can get not only self-reported changes in emotion, but also physiological indices supporting these changes, and show, hopefully, for the research, that the response is greater in the BPD group. So that will hopefully help separate emotion dysregulation from these three disorders as to how they're different. One of the things I'm working on right now is a thought speed study. One of my thoughts with emotional cascades is that I think that they're faster than sort of typical rumination would be like in depression. In my experience, a lot of times when people with BPD are very upset, they're talking very fast, jumping from one thought to the next and very fast, versus in depression, they tend to be a little bit slower in terms of, like, this really sucks, what am I going to do? It's a slower sort of ruminative response. So I have people reading different positive and negative statements at different speeds, faster or slower. And these are just college students at the moment, but we're getting symptoms of BPD, and we're going to try and show that the BPD group has this faster, responds more to this fast negative group, especially if they have higher rates of rumination. I'm currently working on developing an emotional cascade scale, so this is hopefully so I can expand on it beyond measures of rumination. A lot of times I use research measures on rumination. And I'd like to develop a scale that is sort of independent and shows that people with BPD have more of this sort of scale than they would a regular rumination scale. And then finally, I'm working on sort of helping integrate some mindfulness and exercise treatments in terms of reducing rumination in college students. So that's sort of the hope, is that if you can get them to exercise and be mindful, you'll see reductions in rumination, as I would expect you'd also see in bulimia. So I want to point out here a few agencies that have been really helpful for funding my research and helping me continue this work. The Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, and in conjunction with them, the Families for Borderline Personality Disorder Research, as well as the National Institute of Mental Health and Rutgers University for providing me with the resources I need to continue this research. So with that, is there any time for questions?
Thank you. The responses I'm getting is that, wow, one, you have won the audience.
Thank you.
They had had this information years ago, and I think you have everybody salivating to see more, hear more, and hopefully...
Well, I'm working on it.
We could have you come back and address some clinical cases, perhaps.
Sure, I would be happy to do that in the future.
Oh, terrific. We have to stop now, and I'll be in touch with you on some other things. We will not have a call-in next week on the 11th because of the Veterans Day holiday, but we will return on November 18th for a session on adolescence with borderline personality disorder. Everybody be safe and well, and we will hope you can join us on November 18th. Thank you all. Good night.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Ed, so much. Good night.
Good night.